something that's brand new. You see in the chart, oh, hey, it's actually on both screens. How about that? What you see there is the cooling curve of the universe. And that black curve you see there is what the Bible predicts about the cooling of the universe. You say, where is that in Scripture? Well, there's several Bible verses that talk about the universe having a space-time beginning. How the universe has a beginning and is the beginning of all matter, energy, space, and time. And there's 11 passages in the Bible that tell us that the universe continuously expands from that beginning, that it expands under constant laws of physics, where according to Ecclesiastes and Romans and other passages, it's subject to a pervasive law of decay. Well, if you've got a universe expanding from a space-time singularity, that's a universe that would start off nearly infinitely hot. And if it's expanding, it will cool according to the law of decay, what we physicists call the second law of thermodynamics, what some of you might refer to as Murphy's Law. Everything in the universe decays. It's something we observe, something the Bible has stated in many different places. And if the universe is decaying under the second law of thermodynamics, then indeed it must get colder and colder in a highly predictable way. In other words, one external data point that's necessary to get this vividly predicted curve, and that's the age of the universe. The age of the universe is 13.8 billion years, and with that single data point, everything else the Bible says about the universe gives you that curve. Now, we've been able to measure the temperature of the present universe to very high precision. In fact, the number is the universe today. Actually, what we're measuring is the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. As the universe expands, that radiation becomes more and more dissipated, and hence colder and colder. And currently, it measures to be 2.72548 degrees above absolute zero. It's actually known as 5 places of the decimal. And so that's easy to measure with high precision. What's challenging is to measure the past temperature of the universe. What we have to do is look at distant galaxies, in particular gas clouds, and look for certain spectral lines where the strength of those spectral lines is in direct proportion to the temperature of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. As you can see from the chart, once you get sufficiently far back as a look-back time, say looking at galaxies that are more than 2 billion light years away, the error bars get big. In fact, in some cases, the error bars are like, 30%. What is brand new, just published, is that they finally have a measurement of a distant galaxy where they can measure that temperature to better than 2% precision. And that's a little red dot that you see about halfway up the curve. And the error bars are so tiny that the red dot completely obliterates the uncertainty in that measurement. And notice it's right on the curve. So it's demonstrating that what the Bible predicts about the cooling in the universe has been confirmed by actual measurements. Now, there's also a paper that got published just this past week, which is saying, basically analyzing the latest map of the cosmic background radiation. We're looking at it in the temperature that it is today. And this is done by what's called the Planck Collaboration. It's the Planck satellite, and it was sent up by the Europeans to measure the radiation from the cosmic creation event to a much higher degree than what NASA has been able to do with the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe. Up till now, that's where we've gotten our best maps. But this map is so much superior that they're able to measure the way electrons interact with the photons from the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, that within a couple of years, we will be able to measure the cooling of the universe all the way along that curve to about 1% precision. But already, we've got a single data point where the measurement is better than 2% precision. So what it's demonstrating is what the Bible predicted thousands of years ago numerically is correct with respect to the character of the universe. And I think what makes this even more important is that until the 20th century, the Bible was the only book of philosophy, science, or theology that make these statements that the universe is continuously expanding from a space-time beginning under constant laws of physics, for one of those laws is the pervasive law of decay. Until the 20th century, the Bible stood alone in making that claim, and those claims imply that the universe will cool according to that curve, and by confirming that curve, we're confirming that everything the Bible said about the origin and history of the universe indeed is correct. Gee, there's still nobody behind the microphone. Well, someone coming behind the microphone. Yeah, whenever it gets slow, I'll keep going with more discussions.
Don't let him do that. Get up there.
I have a couple of questions, so I know the rules. My first question is, does the Bible say why God made man? You know the verse?
A single verse that talks about why God made man? There were several verses that make the point that God made man to express his glory. In other words, the fundamental purpose of every human being is to reflect and express the glory of God. Now, what you will find, the Bible is really talking about the purpose of humanity, not with single verses, but with whole books and chapters. And in fact, you'll see this in the DVD series about why the universe is the way it is. That God created the universe for many different reasons. But one of the reasons is that he created it to be a tool to eliminate evil and suffering once and for all. But that we human beings are the critical species in bringing about the end of all evil and suffering. God has only created one spiritual species to dwell within this universe. He's created angels, but they're not subject to the physics of the universe. We human beings are. And that God is choosing to use human beings rather than angels to be a tool in his hand for the elimination of all evil and suffering. Or, to put it in the words of the Apostle Paul, we human beings get to experience the grace and the redemption of the Creator in the universe. The angels have to watch. So, if you want an analogy, think of a football stadium. The angels are in the stands watching, and human beings are on the playing field, bringing about, through the grace of God, the end of all evil and suffering. In fact, it tells us in the words of Paul's epistles that the angels long to understand what we experience, which explains why in the new creation, we human beings will be at a higher level than the angels. Right now, we're at a lower level than the angels, but there come a time when we'll be at a higher level, mainly because we get to take courses they don't get to take, to use a college analogy.
I have a therapist friend who says God wanted children, and I think that's appropriate.
You want adopted children.
That's right.
Thank you. Thank you for posting this. The question is, one of the greatest arguments, I think, for the existence of God that I've seen is the fine-tuning of the universe. And of course, just like when the Big Bang was discovered, this has led a lot of physicists, actually just made them very angry. So now the big trump card that they think that they hold in their hand is the multiverse. And so I've researched all over the place, and so they think, oh, the multiverse is 100% true, and people are like, no, it's not. How much evidence do you think they have for the multiverse? And do you think that the multiverse will ever become like a truly accepted theory, like Big Bang theory, or the expanding universe?
Well, there are many different forms for the multiverse. And what I tell my unbelieving physicist friends is the multiverse fundamentally is a Christian doctrine. It's always been a part of Christianity that God has made more than one creation. Now, how many he's made, he hasn't told us, but he certainly has made a different realm for the angels than he's made for us. And that heaven and hell survive the removal of the universe. So there's at least a few of these realms. And if God made an infinite number, well, you know, we don't know. And moreover, people have pointed out that multiverse hypotheses fundamentally are untestable. for the simple reason that, say, if God made a million universes, once you've got observers in one universe, then the space-time manifold or envelope or surface of that universe cannot possibly overlap the space-time surface of any other possibly existing universe, which means it's impossible, by the laws of physics, for us to actually detect another existing universe. So if there's two universes out there, we will never know. Now, in many respects, we know that there's more than just this universe in terms of pure physical reality, because the universe we see through the telescope is the universe of the past. It takes light time to travel from galaxies to our telescope. And with an expanding universe, we're actually seeing a universe that must be smaller than the universe that actually exists. And so that's why we astronomers talk about the observable universe. And the universe that we can theoretically observe is limited by the age of the universe. We can only look back to the creation event. And so, you know, we can see back about 13.8 billion years, but since the universe is expanding, the universe of the present must be bigger than the universe of the past. And also, the latest maps of the cosmic background radiation, both the WMAP and the Planck satellite, have been able to measure the polarization and the temperature fluctuations of the cosmic background radiation. And it's that polarization signature that now proves that the Earth universe had an inflation event. So the universe was about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old and went through an extremely rapid hyper-expansion, many thousands of times faster than the velocity of light. And what astronomers and physicists are really wanting to do is map that cosmic background radiation with enough precision that we can only establish that such an inflationary event took place. But what kind of inflationary event? Because some of these inflation models would actually predict that you're going to get many space-time bubbles coming out of that inflationary realm. And that's what's typically referred to as a level one multiverse. And so most astronomers and physicists are persuaded that the level one multiverse is probably correct. We can't prove it yet, but within a few years we'll know which way it is. But certainly the universe, the real universe of today, is bigger than the universe we see. And some have argued, you know, well, maybe that could impact the fine-tuning argument. Maybe we need 1,000 times more fine-tuning evidence if indeed the actual universe is 1,000 times bigger. And, you know, there's potential that we might actually be able to determine how much bigger the universe of today is than the universe that we can theoretically see. Right now, we're not there yet, but we know that it's probably at least a few dozen times bigger than what we see. Now, in terms of how that impacts fine-tuning, most of the books you get on fine-tuning only speak about fine-tuning on the scale of a whole universe. If you look at the material we've published at Reasons to Believe, we bring that out as well, the point that you see the fine-tuning on all size scales. So if you go from the entire universe and just look at our cluster of galaxies, you see that there's fine-tuning at the level of our cluster of galaxies. There's fine-tuning at the level of our galaxy. Over 200 different features of the Milky Way galaxy have to be fine-tuned for advanced life to be possible here. And then likewise, if you look at the star cluster in which the Sun was born, that has to be fine-tuned. And where it eventually resided after it got kicked out, that has to be fine-tuned. The solar system, suns, planets, and moons have to be fine-tuned. The truth is you see fine-tuning at all size scale levels, all the way down to the electrons and the protons. So no matter what size scale you look at, you see fine-tuning. Which begins to call into question certain non-theists who say, if we go up one level, all the fine-tuning will disappear. Well, wait a minute, everywhere we look, we see that fine-tuning. And every time we've gotten the technology to go a little bit beyond, we see that the fine-tuning evidence grows. The other thing that's interesting is that all these size scales, the fine-tuning evidence is increasing, it's not decreasing. In other words, the more we learn about fundamental particles, the more fine-tuning evidence we find. The more we learn about galaxies, the more fine-tuning evidence we find for a Milky Way galaxy being designed to make life possible. And I would argue that's probably the positive way to put the multiverse model from a non-theistic perspective to the test. I mean, if they're saying it's pure chance, then at some point the design evidence should either stagnate or decrease. It shouldn't continue increasing. I mean, to give you an analogy, I could flip a coin 1 million consecutive times. If it comes up heads 1 million consecutive times, you'd probably justify in saying the coin has been designed to come up heads 1 million consecutive times. But you might, if you appeal to the multiverse, say, well, there could be an infinite number of coins being flipped by an infinite number of people, and this one incidence, they all came up heads by pure chance. But I would suggest before you bet heads or tails on the next flip, that you might want to look at both sides of the coin. In other words, you can choose to examine the coin in more detail to see if there's some explanation for why it's always coming up heads. But that's something we can actually do with the universe. We can choose to examine it in more detail and see whether or not the fine-tuning evidence is increasing or decreasing. And I think another mark in favor of theistic worldview is measuring how fast it's increasing. So, for example, if we're looking at the fine-tuning evidence for our solar system and our galaxy, you can see on our website we have a compendium of this fine-tuning evidence where we've been looking at how that evidence grows over a 20-year period. And over a 20-year period, the evidence for fine-tuning design has been getting roughly a factor of 1 million times stronger every month. So it's an example of dramatically increasing evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design. And therefore, again, I would argue for a theistic interpretation and not an atheistic interpretation. And if you were here yesterday, I pointed out how the multiverse, from an atheistic perspective, is self-defeating. In a sense that the way atheists are proposing is saying there's an infinite number of universes, and actually they're proposing an infinite number of an infinite number of universes, so all possible characteristics in an infinite number of the laws of physics, features of the physics, features of the universe could be represented, so no matter how much fine-tuning evidence you get, you can say it's pure chance. The problem is that would also predict if you would have an infinite number of beaches on an infinite number of planets, just like Earth with infinite number of random markings in the sand, and in those infinite number of random markings would be all the letters and equations in every research paper published by Stephen Hawking, which means that what he's produced is not the product of his mind, it's the product of pure chance. And the thing is, no scientist thinks that way. And notice this. The non-theistic scientists didn't propose that version of the multiverse until the evidence for fine-tuning, in the words of Paul Davies, became overwhelming. In fact, 25 years ago, we were predicting and reasons to believe that they would go there. And so when the evidence becomes really strong, they're going to have no other option but to appeal to the multiverse. And so beginning about 10 years ago, that appeal began to be made. And we argue that's the scientists, how strong the evidence is, that that's really the only place they can go. Go ahead.
I read a couple of years ago that the sun in our solar system was going to last, or has enough mass to last, about 50 million years, or maybe it was some other number, but 50 million was what I remember. Might have been 15 million.
About 4.5 billion. It's got another 4.5 billion years to go.
My question is it sensible for a Christian to expect Jesus not to come back until the sun burns out? Or is it sensible to expect Jesus to come back sooner than when the sun burns out?
Well, it's not as silly a question as it sounds, because I was at Reformed Theological Seminary in Florida, where I met a number of theologians with doctorates who were speculating that maybe the return of Jesus Christ to planet Earth would be as much as 3 or more million years off into the future. And so as a physicist, I was explaining to them that based on what we know about the sun, is going to have to happen faster than that. The sun has got 4.5 billion years left in terms of its nuclear fusion history. But the thing about the sun is, as it continues to fuse hydrogen into helium and warm us up, the conversion of hydrogen to helium makes the core of the sun denser as it continues to burn. And that increasing density causes the sun's furnace to grow more and more efficient. And so astronomers recognize is that the sun for the past 3.5 billion years has been gradually getting brighter and brighter with respect to time. Now, the reason why life has been stable on planet Earth for 3.8 billion years is what you see in Psalm 104. That's a property of all life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the Earth. And you actually see this in the fossil record, where you see wholesale extinctions of life, where anywhere from, say, 40 to 95% of all species of life are removed, and removed by a variety of events. But what happens is very shortly after the mass extinction event, you get a mass speciation event, where millions of new species replace the ones that have been taken away. But what's interesting is that the species that replace the species that have been driven to extinction are more efficient in pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And so the sun has been getting brighter and brighter. Life on planet Earth, through God's constant reintroduction of new forms of life, has been gradually pulling more and more greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And it's such that the temperature of the surface of the Earth for the past 3.8 billion years has remained at a level that's ideal for life. But there's a limit to how long you can keep that going. I mean, if you start pulling enough greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, then plants, for example, won't have enough of those greenhouse gases to be able to photosynthesize. And when photosynthesis stops, inevitably all life dies. You say, well, how soon is that going to happen? Well, on an astronomical time scale, it's going to happen quite soon. Within 30 million years, all life on planet Earth must go extinct because it will no longer be possible to pull a green or pull enough. If you pull enough greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, eventually photosynthesis stops, then all life ceases. That's going to happen in 30 million years for all life. The problem is the more higher up you are on the kind of the chain of life, then the faster it could go extinct. And so, for example, with human beings, you're looking within less than a million years the planet not being suitable for our inhabitation, no matter what life you have here on planet Earth. And you're talking about civilization, and we have to head much faster than that. In fact, if you take this DVD series, what we point out is we've probably only got about 10,000 years left. So on that basis, I would say, based on Christian doctrine, the return of the Lord to planet Earth will happen in the next 10,000 years. So it's not going to be millions of years off. It's going to be much less than that. And you say, how much less? Hey, the promise of the Bible is, and we take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world, then he's coming back. So as soon as that job is done, he's coming back. We don't have to wait 10,000 years. It can happen a lot faster. In fact, a fellow who used to come to the Paradoxes class, Rob Winter, the U.S. Center for World Mission, he's written papers to the effect that it could happen within 5 years if Christians take their mandate of the Bible seriously enough.
Isn't it likely, too, Hugh, that an asteroid would hit us, a life-ending asteroid, before the sun burns out?
Yes. Before the sun burns out, I mean, the sun's going to go for another 4.5 billion years. So, yeah, before it burns out, it's inevitable that we're going to be smashed by a big asteroid. And, if you're a termite or a cockroach, you'll probably survive, but not if you're a human being. So, and you say, how often does that happen? Well, about once every 50 million years. In fact, that's what's responsible for some of the major mass extinction events. Other things that can happen are super volcanoes, there's lots of little things that eliminate light from planet Earth to a large degree. What was interesting is it's fine-tuned. The mass extinction events we see happen at just the right frequency and intensity so that the mass speciation events can work to keep the temperature of the surface of the Earth ideal for life. So we don't have too many of these mass extinction events. We don't have too few. We have just the right number to maintain life on planet Earth for 3.8 billion years. And keep in mind this, we wouldn't be able to build Los Angeles unless we had 3.8 billion years of biodeposits in the crust of the Earth. So there's a reason why God makes us last of all. By making us last of all, we can have all this technology. If he made us earlier, then we wouldn't have the resources we need to be able to build cities and transportation systems and iPhones.
Go ahead.
So I'm trying to another question here. My question is that in terms of like the debate between macroevolution and creationism, sometimes Christians say, well, as long as we admit that like God created the first life in the first place, it doesn't really matter if he successfully kept creating life after that or if he just let evolution take place. So my question is, some friends think that way, is from maybe theological perspective than just scientific, because I know a lot of the scientific reasons. From a more theological perspective, what would be the difference between obviously God interacting, creating life, all life by himself, or letting it go? And so like the watchmaker argument that lots of people put forward.
Well, it's a good question, and I agree with you that the science is much more definitive on your question than the Bible is. But the Bible does put some limits on this. Talks about in Genesis 1 creatures reproducing after their own kind. And the Hebrew word there is min, and there's been some debate about, you know, does that mean the species level, the genus level, family level, phyla level? Well, there's places, particularly in the Torah, where it gives you examples of what the limits of that min really is. For example, there is a passage in Leviticus that names six different kinds of owls as separate men. However, there's another passage also in Leviticus that talks about four different insects as being separate men. And what's interesting is when you look at the insect level, it's about the level of the genus, whereas in terms of the owls, it's at the level of the species. Now, keep in mind, in biology, we don't have firm limits for what a species is or a genus is. After all, it's biology, it's complicated. There aren't any hard and fast ways to classify with the boundaries. In fact, my colleague Fuzz Rod recently has found 16 different definitions of a species in the biological literature. So you have to keep in mind, it's not like physics where we kind of have a pretty good idea what a proton is and what a neutron is. We have a hard time defining this. And evidently, the Bible does indicate that it's difficult to define what this is. But in terms of what you see in the book of Job and Psalms and Genesis, in terms of where you see verbs that indicate that God is personally and directly involved, and these would be the verbs of saw and bara, which means to create and to make. Both of those verbs would imply that God is directly and miraculously involved in bringing about those species. Those words are used for human beings. They're used for birds and mammals. They're not used for other life forms. For other life forms, it uses the verb hayah. And that verb means, like, let there be. And that could imply supernatural intervention on the part of the Creator, or it could imply that God is working through the natural process. So it's an open-ended position, physically, for the lower life forms. But once you get to what are called the soulish animals, which are the birds, mammals, and a few of the higher reptilian species that will sacrifice in order to care for the young, that's kind of how the Bible defines the soulish animals. You actually see altruistic behavior in the part of parents towards their young, and do we see them forming emotional bonds, and do they have the capability of emotionally bonding to human beings? And so I would include all the birds and all the mammals. I would include crocodiles and alligators, although they're very challenging compared to that kind of relationship. It has been done. In fact, in the Book of Job, it tells us that the Leviathan, which would be the crocodile, is the most difficult of all the nephesh creatures for human beings to tame and form an emotional relationship with. It can be done, but it's extremely difficult. And what's interesting, too, is the Book of Job says, as difficult as it is to tame a crocodile, it's even more challenging to tame a proud human being. And the point there is that as it takes a higher species to tame these nephesh animals, likewise it takes a higher being to tame a human being. So when you try to tame a proud human being by your own effort, you're going to discover you're dealing with something a lot more challenging than a crocodile. So that's where the limits lie biblically, and so the Bible actually allows a fair amount of room for the scientists to explore what's happening with the lower life forms. In terms of the first life, yeah, I would argue the Bible does claim that God is responsible for that first life, and the latest evidence in the origin of life is telling us that we're not looking at just a single original life form, that the first life is an ecology of life, not a single species.
Go ahead, Al.
we're saying that talking about how long the world's going to end, 10,000 years, but it seems to me Jesus said to his followers a couple of times that they would not die before he came returned. So I think he needs a little fine tuning there somewhere.
Well, what you're looking at is what's called the Olivet Discourse. It's Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. And the real passage to look at is Matthew 24. Because what you see in Luke and Mark is the disciples asking one question. What you see in the book of Matthew is they actually ask two questions. Now, it sounds like one question, but it's actually two questions. And the question they're asking is, Lord, when will this temple be destroyed, and when will you return? And his answer is the generation that sees these events take place. And he names 25 things that will happen before these things take place. This is when a generation that sees that, these 25 signs, that generation will not pass until the temple is destroyed and I return. Now, what we're seeing there in the Olivet Discourse is something that's very common in the Old Testament, where a prophet would make a prophecy, what would sound like it would be a single event, but it was actually two events at two different times. I mean, a good example from the book of Isaiah is that Isaiah prophesies the virgin will give birth to a male child. But what you notice is that a child has two different names, as referring to two different virgins.
And they would be called Emmanuel. It never happened. It was called Jesus.
Well, that's one of
so
the...
So you must have had two.
Okay. But the whole point is...
David's doing his job.
He's doing his job. That's what he's there for.
It's one question, Alan. You seem to have problems with rules. Thank you.
Okay. But the point is, what you're seeing there in the Olivet Discourse is a double prophecy. Just like the double prophecy that Isaiah made about the virgin.
Which one is right?
Okay, they're both right. Okay. The generation that saw these 25 signs were basically those people who lived shortly after the crucifixion of Christ. And they saw those signs, and then with that generation that saw those signs, they did not pass away before the temple was destroyed. But here's the thing, those 25 signs are going to happen again. So just like there were two virgins, there's going to be two different times in human history when a generation will see these 25 disasters take place. Now, what's interesting about the history of that time is that Christians who were aware of the Olivet Discourse, you know, one of the 25 signs is when you see the army surrounding or coming to surround Jerusalem, head for the hills. The Christians headed for the hills and they escaped out of the wrath of the Emperor Titus.
That's when the temple was destroyed.
That's when the temple was destroyed. But notice that there were people reading the scriptures and said, this is the time, these signs are taking place, we're seeing everything that Jesus prophesied occurring. He told us to head for the hills, we're heading for the hills. And so, they did not think,
come on, Al, give somebody else a chance.
Yeah, give me a chance here. If you see those 25 signs happen again, then the generation that sees those 25 signs happening again will not pass before the Lord returns.
Not yet.
Okay.
People,
you know,
we don't see you heading the
hill
to you, Al.
Yeah, I'm not yet. Okay, but the thing you need to realize is that Jesus was simply realizing, he was talking to an audience that was familiar with double prophecies. And so, for example, those Christians that headed for the hills to escape Titus's legions, they understood that this all of the discourse would be fulfilled twice. Notice that Elijah comes twice. Jesus comes twice. There are two virgins. There are two sons that come from the virgins. Just like there's two fulfillments of the Olivet Discourse. And keep in mind, this is a great way to write scripture. Because you get to say in one chapter something that would take ordinary people about 10 chapters to say. That's the thing to appreciate, is that the Bible is on purpose a very compact book. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I'm really excited. This is my first time here. And I'm happy to see that I'm not the only one searching for a spot.
Welcome.
Well, I have so many questions in my head right now, but I want to go on topic. Now, you said that this creation was predicted in the Bible. Is there any reason why you could think this? Why is it pointed to the Bible? What's the reason for this prediction?
Yeah, well, what prediction are you talking about?
Temperature we're talking about.
Oh, this one here.
I'm going on top of this.
Right.
So, yeah, you said the Bible is predicting this. Is there any reason why they're predicting this and the enemy of us?
Well, I think there is, because if you look at the competing religions to Christianity, every one of them has got a cosmology. And the reason why you see such a detailed cosmology in the Bible, and actually it is very detailed, the Bible's got 10 times as much to say about the origin and structure of the universe as the rest of the world's major holy books combined. But all these holy books make cosmological claims. And so starting right with Genesis 1, you see a very different kind of cosmology. And the reason why is God is saying, you can put this to the test. See who got the cosmology right.
But didn't they say the earth was the center of the universe at one point?
There were people who thought that, yes. The Bible didn't say that. What's interesting about the Bible is it describes the universe as a surface phenomenon. We did not know that was correct until about 30 years ago. And so just like we human beings live on the surface of the earth and not its interior, likewise we now understand that all the stars and galaxies are on the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional earth. But it was David and Isaiah that said first. Okay, what the Bible is saying is this is what the universe is like.
So
this is what I would call a scientific prediction, where the Bible is making statements about scientific reality that thousands of years later, scientists, human scientists, can put to the test and see whether or not the Bible got it right or were the Hindu Vedas right. We now know that the Vedas are wrong and the Bible is correct.
I think part of the reason that the Bible makes these predictions is so in times like now, if we can say that the Bible is truthful in history and in science, then we can trust it in what it says about God and what He promises to us.
That's another question. I have that question.
Well, like a double prophecy, you got a two-answer question there.
Well, I had a question, regarding between young earth and old earth creationism. I'm kind of more familiar with a young earth perspective and lots of speaking from, probably more familiar with speaking from like Dr. Kent Hovind. So kind of seeing a lot of their use of the flood and a lot of explaining why the world looks the way it does now. how would you use the flood in describing, and how, yeah, how would you use it?
Well, Genesis 6, 7, and 8 are not the only passages in the Bible that talk about the flood. There are many other passages as well. I mean, in 2 Peter 2 and 2 Peter 3, it refers to the world that was flooded. Now, what you have in Greek is the word cosmos. It can mean universe, or it can mean a planet, or it can mean part of a planet. But in both cases, Peter chooses to qualify the word cosmos. So he says in 2 Peter 2, the world of the ungodly was flooded. But he says in 2 Peter 3, cosmos tote, the world at the time the event took place was flooded. Now the fact that Peter finds it necessary to attach adjectives to cosmos tells us it's not the whole globe. Now if you want something explicit, there are five places in the Bible where it talks about creation day 3, when God makes continents for the first time. So the Bible is quite explicit that the world starts off as a water world. And we now know that from geophysics, that indeed planet Earth began with no land at all, with just ocean everywhere. Creation day 3, that could be the great land masses. Now what you see in several parallel texts, Psalm 104, Proverbs 8, Job 38, those are three texts that take you through the six creation days, just like Genesis 1 does. It doesn't name them like day 1, day 2, day 3, but all the content is there. And when it addresses creation day 3, it talks about how God set up barriers so that you have oceans and continents. It actually refers to the continent of the land masses as bars and gates and barriers. And what you see in Psalm 104, verse 9, is once the continents are in place, never again will water cover the whole face of the earth. And that's repeated five times in the Bible. You won't see it in Genesis, but it's five times in the Psalms, Job, and Proverbs, where it makes it clear that once you've got continents, never again are you going to get a water world. Now, I'm on record as believing that the flood of Noah is worldwide. But I'm also on record in believing that it's not global. And what I notice is this global flood idea was a 20th century invention. What's unique about the 20th and 21st centuries is we are global citizens. But that was not true of people living before us. And so Paul, for example, would speak about the Roman Christians and said, your faith has been heard throughout the whole world. Well, for him, the whole world was the Roman Empire. He was not claiming the Aborigines had heard of the faith of the Christians in Rome. And likewise, you see the Bible making a comment about King Solomon, the wisest of all the kings that ever ruled the face of the earth. And it says the kings and queens of the whole world came to his court to hear of his great wisdom. You read two verses further on in Kings, it tells you they came from as far away as southern Arabia and Ethiopia. That was the whole world in the context of Solomon and the nation of Israel at that time. And so how extensive was the flood? The whole world of humanity was impacted by the flood. But if human beings have not yet settled Greenland, there's no need for God to flood Greenland. He only has to flood the world of the ungodly. So the answer to the question, how extensive was the flood of Genesis? It was extensive enough to wipe out all humanity and all their nephesh animals that were associated with them, the birds and animals, that is, except for those on board the ark. So, in that sense, I believe in a worldwide flood, but not a global flood. Yes?
Hi, I'm Tristan. Sorry if this is a ubiquitous question. But purportedly, there's like a dichotomy between the biological clock and like the world being created at the 11th hour or whatever in the 13.8 billion year old series and like the 6 day series. And I know that there's like a Hebrew word for day that's not completely translated to coexist with English. Could you like explain that?
Yes, I mean, notice that this debate about the age of the earth amongst Christians is basically an English language debate. When I travel to other countries, I don't see them getting all disturbed about this like they do here in the United States and other English-speaking countries. I think there's a good reason for that. The English language is the largest vocabulary language that any human being has ever spoken. And to be fluent in biochemistry, you need to know about 2 million words. It's over 4 billion words in the English language. Biblical Hebrew, there's only 3,000 words if you don't count the names of people and cities. So Biblical Hebrew ranks as one of the smallest vocabulary languages that has ever existed. Now, how the Hebrew deals with that is that the nouns, almost every Hebrew noun has multiple literal definitions. I'll give you an example from the New Testament. Remember in Corinthians where Paul says, I was taken up to the third heaven? The reason why he said the third heaven is the Hebrew word for heaven has three different definitions. So he's explaining, no, I'm not taken up to the atmosphere where the rain clouds form. I wasn't taken up to where the stars and galaxies are. That's definition number two. He was taken to definition number three, that realm beyond the space-time envelope of the universe. The Hebrew word yom, that's translated day, has four different definitions. It can mean part of the daylight hours, like from noon to 3 p.m. It can mean all of the daylight hours. It can be a 24-hour period, or it can be a long but finite period of time. And if you look at the Old Testament, the two most frequent definitions you see are the daylight hours and a long period of time. The 24-hour idea is actually quite rarely used in the Old Testament. Now, you have to look at the context. By the way, in Biblical Hebrew, the only word you've got for an epoch of time is the word yom. Mm-hmm. There is no other word. In modern-day Hebrew, they've got two words. But in Biblical Hebrew, the only word you've got is the word yom. So Moses had no other word to use if you want to describe a long period of time. Now, the first time I read the Bible seriously was when I was 17. And I started on page 1 with Genesis 1. And it was obvious to me within 30 minutes these days had to be long periods of time. For the following reason. You get an evening and a morning for the first 6 days, but there is no evening and morning for day 7. Now, I recognize at the age of 17 that the chapter breaks are artificial. I think one reason why a lot of English readers miss this is that the seventh day is discussed in Genesis 2, not Genesis 1. If you look in the first few verses of Genesis 2, there's no evening or morning for day 7.
Yeah, now, I read the Bible when I was 17, and I kind of puzzled about that too.
Yeah, there's no evening and morning for day 7. Moreover, you continue reading in the Bible, Psalm 95, John 5, and Hebrews 11, refer to the seventh creation day as the event that's not yet finished. We're still in the seventh day. Now, when I read that at age 17, I said, that answers the fossil record enigma. What's the fossil record enigma? We see plenty of scientific evidence for speciation events before humanity. We see very little after humanity. Well, for 6 days God creates, that explains all the speciation events we see in the fossil record. On the seventh day, he stops creating, which explains the paucity that we see today. The other thing I noticed at age 17 is that you've got the human male and the human female made on day 6. But in Genesis 2, it describes a sequence of events between God creating Adam and creating Eve. And you can look at that carefully. It's a minimum of 6 months of labor that Adam has to perform before God creates Eve. Moreover, God is looking at Adam and says he's lonely. You don't get lonely in a few seconds. It takes longer to get lonely than a few seconds. And after all, he had to name all the nephesh animals that were there. I think God was making a point here. He says, notice that I designed each of these species of nephesh animals to serve and please you. And they each do it in a different way. Give them an appropriate name for the way they relate to you. And you know, it takes time to name a couple of thousand bird and mammal species.
Finally, no one knows.
Well,
We now know there were twice as many mammal species at the time of Adam than there was today, and twice as many bird species. So I think he was busy. And then finally, God introduces him to Eve. But now that I know a little bit about the Hebrew, it's interesting, the word that comes out of Adam's mouth when he sees Eve, it's the Hebrew word papaham. You'll see it about 20 times in the Old Testament, consistently translated at long last. So the fact that Adam would utter those words means this is more than a few seconds. And the 6 days is a long period of time, and the 7th day is a long period of time. The grammatical structure of Genesis 1 would tell us all 7 days are long periods of time, and therefore there's no conflict between the biblical time scale for creation and the scientific time scale. They're in harmony.
Maybe they should retranslate days.
Well, the reason why no translation is used a different word than day is because the Hebrew language only has that one word. I mean, it's not like English where we've got words for all different kinds of periods of time. That's not the way. I mean, Hebrew does have a word for year. They have a word for week, but they don't have a word for a long period of time. The only word they got is the word yom, that can mean a long period of time. So I do think it's correctly translated, but it's important to realize, you know, it's a real challenge to translate from Hebrew into English, which is why I think it's good to get all 60 translations of the Old Testament.
Hugh, I think we need to take a little bit of a break here and start collecting the cards.
Yeah, let's get the cards so we can start giving away all this stuff.
So after the next question, we'll do the drawing. And I want to say one more thing. There are no questions that are off topic. If you want to get up there and ask a question on a topic that's completely different than what's been asked, that's completely fine. There's no...
If it's about sports, you're going to have to feel it.
All right.
Okay, one question I want to ask about a definite topic that's of concern to me, primarily because I'm not probably grow up the next 60 years with this kind of culture. And that's the culture that I'm seeing in science right now, and that's the philosophy of scientism. It says that science and materialistic knowledge explains any and all things thanks to the supposed genius of Stephen Hawking and his book, The Grand Design, that philosophy is dead. Lawrence Krauss, Richard Dawkins, all of them are just, you know, clamoring down at this view. And you know, I know there's going to be a documentary coming out called The Unbelievers soon. I'm sure it's going to be a lot of critical acclaim. Do you feel that the science community is heading towards that scientism? Or is it a fringe group of science, and do you feel that the scientific community is resisting that?
Well, the interesting about the scientific community is that when it comes to belief, they seem to be relatively static. Surveys done of American men and women of science done in 1916 revealed that about 45% of all practicing research scientists believe in God and an afterlife. That survey was repeated in 1996, and they got the same number, about 45%. Now, it does vary discipline to discipline. Mathematicians, for example, are much more likely to believe in sociologists. But, you know, if you surveyed a whole group, it's about 45%. So my conclusion is that scientists are no different from the rest of the population. Some believe, some don't believe. And the Bible told us that it would never be a majority that would believe. So, in that sense, I'm encouraged, too, by what I see in some of the books from the new atheist physicists. Lawrence Krauss's latest book, A Universe from Nothing, if you read about 80% of the way through the book, he does concede, based on the space-time theorems, that a deistic worldview cannot be denied. And what you're seeing in Stephen Hawking's book, The Grand Design, is a denial of a personal God. Not a God that's responsible for creating the universe, is setting up the math and physics, but he's very much opposed to the idea that there's a God that is personal. And by the way, I have a friend who lived with him for 4 years, and his comment is that Stephen, in fact, he's put this in print, that he really does not like the idea of a God that's evaluating his life.
And so it's his personal autonomy that I think is motivating him to find some way out from a personal God. So let me try to make this simple for you. If God is not personal, if God is not alive, if God is not conscious, but simply the grand physics equation creator, then how do you explain that the universe contains beings that are conscious, that are living, that are personal, that are thinking, emotional, and spiritual? And fundamentally, what you're asking from these atheists is a violation of the principle of cause and effect. The lesser cannot create the greater. And so, you know, a single human being is greater than 50 billion trillion stars. 50 billion trillion stars are nothing but balls of gas. Every one of you is a lot more than a ball of gas.
All right, let's do a drawing here. Where are the cards?
They're still collecting.
They're still collecting.
We'll
okay.
Then we'll give stuff away.
We have them.
Oh, we got them. All right.
All right. Last chance to put any cards in here. All right, Hugh, what are we doing, giving away first?
First thing we'll give away is a DVD called The Great Debate. That's not the title we put on it, that's the title the Skeptic Society put on it. And every 2 years they have an international conference, and they invited me to debate Victor Sayer, particle physicist, on the issue of whether or not science supports the existence of God. So we do the entire debate, including all the Q&A. By the way, you can get this from the Skeptic Society. It's going to want 30 of your dollars. We sell it for $5. And we want you to see the debate. And especially we want you to hear the final words that Victor Sayer says at the end of the debate. So someone's going to get this for free.
And the person who gets it for free is... Ryan Marandino. What's next, Hugh?
Next is this book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. We've talked a lot about it already, but it explains how the physics of the universe is set up to eliminate evil and suffering once and for all, and contrast that with the physics of the creation and replace our creation.
Whoever gets this has got the head start on the chapter meeting next week. And that person is going to be Anthony Torres. I think there's a little fine-tuning going on in this row right here.
All right. Hopefully it won't be that way. Cosmic Fingerprints. This is a DVD we made where I was in front of an audience of basically skeptical Christians who are disagreeing with my position. That's also where I tell a story of how astrophysics properly stays.
All right. Let's see if it's one of these two girls right here. Barbara Yeagle. Wow. Pretty close.
I know, just like you live in a fine-tuned location or galaxy, you live in a fine-tuned location.
That's right. Well, thank you all for doing.
Go ahead.
I go to a school where a lot of skeptics go, but on the, you know, if you look at it, a lot of them do. But one of the points that I've argued with a lot of them, and one of the points they bring up is, if God is real, then why does he let all the horrible things happen to him in the past, like terrorists of 9/11 and a couple of other things that I'm pretty sure we all know about. Now, obviously, I know that God is real, but they bring up a good point, so...
Well, that is a good point, and it's really the only argument that atheists have for their position. Only positive argument. They got lots of negative arguments. Most common arguments I hear is, you Christians do such a terrible job of arguing for your God. That's true. I mean, we don't always argue as well as we should. But the one piece of evidence they have is, if God is all-powerful, all-suffering, then why do you have all this evil and suffering? And if every religion tries to answer that question, I argue that only Christianity provides a satisfactory answer. And this is something I noticed when I was checking up the different religions when I was 17 and 18 years of age. When you look at the non-biblical religions, they're basically what I would call one creation models, where God creates a universe. And what's interesting is that all these major religions teach that humanity started off in paradise. Somehow we lost paradise, but God or gods or cosmic forces are on a mission to bring us back to paradise. What you see in the Bible is something radically different. God is not on a mission to bring us back to paradise. He's on a mission to take us someplace far better than paradise. And it was necessary to get to that far better realm that we go through a test. And to give you an analogy, it sounds like you're from some kind of teaching institution.
No, I go to a public school.
Going to a public school? Well, that's a teaching institution. Hopefully it still is. But you know, what happens in junior high, high school, undergraduate, graduate education, is that your teachers and professors subject you to a limited amount of suffering. I mean, my role as a professor is to make my students suffer. If I don't make them suffer, I'm not doing my job. Now, you might say, well, what is it that motivates my students to pay money to suffer at my hand? Two things. They know the suffering is temporary. They only have to put up with me for a semester. And number two, they know the suffering will prepare them for a career that they otherwise could not partake in without that experience of the suffering. Likewise, the Bible's message is that God is preparing us for very challenging careers in the new creation. And those careers require training. And that training means that we need to be exposed to a brief period of evil and suffering. I know this is brief. It's only a few decades compared to all of eternity in which you get to enjoy your career. And moreover, what you see in the Bible is people like Peter and Paul who actually relish and enjoy to a great degree the suffering they're going through. And I've always seen that as my role as a professor. My best students actually enjoy the suffering. In fact, they'll come to me and say, hey, professor, I want to suffer more. And so, you know, I have to make the course a little bit harder if I got really good students. And, I remember that experience myself as a student. It's like, there's some kind of enjoyment of being able to see the benefit firsthand of that suffering. And this is also what Peter and Paul ask us to do. Okay, the suffering you're going through will have an eternal purpose, but it also has a purpose right here and now. Discover what that is. And that's how you can enjoy your present suffering. Peter and Paul were able to see immediate benefits of the suffering they went through. All things work together for good for those who are called to God's purpose and love what He's doing. And you can actually see that firsthand. And many of us in this room have had that experience. So in that sense, yes, the suffering has pain, but you can see the benefit of it. You don't have to wait for eternity to see the benefit of it. Now, when I write about why the universe is the way it is, which is seen in the DVD series, is God is certainly powerful enough that He could deliver every human being from disease, earthquakes, tornadoes, whatever. He could do that. In fact, what you see in the Bible is that occasionally He does intervene to rescue people from imminent disaster. But notice, He does it only on rare occasions. If He did it all the time, it would basically blunt the benefit of us being exposed to the law of decay, for example. It's the law of decay that actually helps us to avoid evil and pursue virtue. That's what I write about in the book, that the laws of thermodynamics are optimally designed. If you increase the level of entropy, things are worse. If you decrease the level of entropy, things are worse. They're optimally designed to give us the maximum motivation to work and create and enjoy what we create, but at the same time, they're optimally designed to discourage us from pursuing evil and to motivate us to pursue virtue. And if God rescued us too frequently from the consequences of the second law of thermodynamics, it would blunt the real benefit of us being exposed to those consequences of decay, so that we can overcome evil and gain a virtuous life. Because that's really what the life of the Christian is all about. It's step-by-step seeing our spirit renewed, where we commit less and less evil and perform more and more virtue as time goes by. None of that will happen if God constantly delivers us from gravity, thermodynamics, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak nuclear force. So all those laws of physics are in place as a training ground. And notice that the Bible says, no one gets to the new creation without going through the test. Just like nobody gets a PhD without going through a test. And if I could use that as an example, God on purpose subjects us to the most difficult test in the context of evil. Who went into the Garden of Eden? The most powerful creature that God ever created. Satan. Yes. God could have invited a lesser fallen angel to come in, but no, it was Satan himself that came in. That meant that Adam and Eve and all the rest of us had the benefit of being exposed to the most challenging test in the context of evil. And if you pass that test, there's nothing else that can ever trip you up. Just like the degree I have in my office says PhD on it, it guarantees that never again will I have to be tested for my competency in astronomy based on the presumption that I've already been subjected to the most difficult test, therefore it's pointless to test me again. So it's important that each of us go through a strong test. But the amazing thing is, it only lasts a few decades. That to me is the wonder of it all, how God can prepare us for these incredible careers and new creation in just a few decades.
I want to say something on that too. I want to talk about this from a personal standpoint. I think if there were not pain and suffering in my life, I would be a pretty narcissistic, self-centered person. And if when there is pain and suffering, it allows other people to reach out to me to try to help, and it makes me aware of the fact that other people suffer too, and it forces me into relationship to try to help other people. And I think if there was no pain and suffering, we would have no reason for God. And so that's a part of the universe that's built in, that's necessary for us really to be in relationship with each other and with God.
Yeah, the other religion is the evil and suffering is gratuitous. In Christianity, the evil and suffering has an ultimate good purpose. Go ahead.
I had a question on Noah's Ark, but someone else kind of told me something on that one. But
I'd like to pick your brain a little bit about the lifespan of people back in the Old Testament and the reference of the modern understanding of biology.
Well, there are some theologians who think that those lifespans are not the same as, are the same as they are today, and they counted years differently. And it is true that ancient civilizations in that part of the world had a different year than we have. Their year was 360 days. However, what they did is they had a 5 or 6 day celebration to take care of the extra days. The ancient astronomers knew the length of the year to within a few minutes. It's amazing how well they had that pinned down. So I think there's good evidence that these are the same years that we're celebrating today. In one sense, they have to be, because if you were to shrink that 900 years down to, say, the 70 or 80, then you've got people having children when they're only 5 years of age. So I think they really did, or the Bible really is claiming that these people get to be 800 or 900 years each. Now, if you want to live that long, you have to be a vegetarian. But notice what God said. No meat until after the flood. Only after the flood were humans allowed to eat meat. By the way, I'm not a vegetarian. I'm not going to live long enough for it to make any difference. So if you're going to live to only be 120, then you can eat meat. It's not going to make any real difference. But if you want to live to be 900, yeah, you need to avoid eating meat. So the other thing we noticed is that humanity was not global. Given that humanity was not global at that time, there is at least the possibility that humanity was not exposed to igneous rocks. Every human being today is exposed to igneous rocks, which means you're going to be exposed to the decay of uranium and thorium and other, you know, radiometric elements. And that will ultimately bring about your demise. And likewise, we're all exposed to cosmic rays. If you live in Denver, you're going to live 3 months less than if you live in the sea level, just because they get more cosmic rays than the rest of us.
But all of us get enough cosmic rays that we're not going to live to be hundreds of years of age. So it's interesting, this is something that you'll see in my next book on the first 11 chapters of Genesis, is there are two astronomers who have discovered a supernova remnant that's 25 degrees across in the sky. Because it is that big, it's been very difficult to discover. But what they now recognize is that one supernova event is responsible for virtually all the fast-moving, heavy nuclei cosmic rays. And they're the ones that do your body the greatest damage. You know, having a bunch of electrons situated so bad, but having uranium nuclei moving at high velocities, that's another matter. Or even oxygen or iron ions hitting you at high velocity. And they now recognize that this is a supernova event that must have exploded sometime in the past 100,000 years. Well, they exploded at the time of Noah. That means before Noah, not that many deadly cosmic rays, whereas after Noah there is. And if people weren't exposed to igneous rocks, that would help. If they're eating vegetables, that would help. But here's another factor, is that they would have to have less aggressive telomerase activity in their chromosomes. Because right now, the older you get, the shorter your chromosomes become. And that's a good thing, because if your chromosomes weren't getting shorter, your cancer risk would go way up. And so the shortening of your chromosomes actually extends your lifespan, but the shortening of your chromosomes also means you're not going to make it past about 120 years. When you get to be that old, the chromosomes are just too short to keep you alive. So, but hey, if you don't have cosmic ray damage to the degree that we do, and if you don't have igneous rock exposure, and you're eating vegetables, then there's no reason why God couldn't give you less aggressive telomerase activity than you could live 800 or 900 years. And saying all that, I believe that today we have the longest average lifespan. Because what we see in the book of Genesis, a few people were living to be 800 or 900 years of age. But the vast majority of the world's population in the days before the flood were having their lives ended as a result of murder by their fellow man.
Yeah.
The murder rate was completely out of control. In fact, the flood was designed to save humanity from self-extermination. In fact, we calculate based on what we see in the book of Genesis that at least 19 out of 20 humans in the days before the flood were having their lives terminated by murder. And so only a few were making it to be 800 or 900 years of age. So in that sense, I think today you actually have people on average living longer than they did in the days before the flood.
So you can think of all that radiation when you order your granite countertops.
Well, if you're a builder, you know that some granite tabletops are worse than others.
That's right.
So you should test your granite tabletops.
You, by contrast, I talked about the evidence. We do have baleen whales that we have provable evidence of at least 220 years. And clams living, 400, 500, 600 years. So biologically, today there are animals that live much longer than we do. So
you
just don't hear a lot about it.
That's true. And the thing about whales is they're not exposed to igneous rocks.
Yep.
So, given that they spend quite a bit of time below the surface, they don't get exposed to the same degree of cosmic rays. So that helps.
Yeah.
But one of the
clams
things
off Iceland don't get much either.
They don't get much either. But one of the things that's special about we human beings, we're on the top of the pile in terms of how many heartbeats we have. So turtles, for example, can live to be 200 years, but hey, they don't do much in those 200 years.
So. The outdoor is long, the cooling planet is not the worst problem in life today.
Well, the climate would say the worst problem is sin, right? Okay, go ahead.
I have a more lighthearted question for Star Trek fans, I'd say.
Yeah.
In reading Why the Universe the Way It Is, I read it twice now, talk a lot about panspermia theories and interstellar space travel. I definitely think that it's pretty much impossible for interstellar space travel, but there are some scientists that are convinced that we can accomplish a warp drive. Do you think that's an actual possibility that humans will actually be able to leave this solar system and go explore?
Well, it's actually a scientist that volunteers for reasons to believe that wrote a paper about how to make a warp drive. And what he was pointing out is that mathematically it's possible that you could make a spaceship that could go faster than the velocity of light. The problem is, just to move, say, one human being, you need to consume the mass of Jupiter every microsecond. So it gets to be impractical on a physical scale. And also, when you begin to be moving at those velocities, then you begin to do damage to biological material. But he was saying, maybe we can send something non-biological at that velocity, but still the energy consumption basically is impossible. And it's based on one model of physics that may or may not be true. So the bottom line is, it can't be done. I mean, one reason why I struggle watching Star Wars or Star Trek is that I count so many times per minute they violate the laws of physics. More than four.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Michael, and I am a public school teacher, so we know about suffering. My question relates to the existence of the universe. Several decades ago now, the late Dr. Walter Martin, in his tape, Seven Campus Curses, mentioned that there are only four possibilities for the existence of the universe. Number one, the universe is eternal. Number two, the universe is an illusion. Number three, the universe sprang into existence out of nothing. Or number four, the universe was created by something or someone outside it. My question is, as an apologetic today, is that argument good or does it need to be sharpened up?
I would say it's a good argument, and it's strongly buttressed by the space-time theorems, especially the latest of the space-time theorems, the one published in 2005 by Arvind Bordé, Alexander Blinken, and Alan Guth, which states that any universe that expands must be traceable back to a space-time beginning, where the causal agent for the universe must be some kind of entity capable of creating independent of matter, energy, space, and time. And what's interesting about that definition, that isolates the God of the Bible from the God of Hinduism and Buddhism, for example. What you see in the non-biblical religions is that God or gods create within space and time that eternally exists. And where the Bible stands alone is saying, no, space and time did not exist until God created the universe. And now we've got theorems of physics that prove that. So, and by the way, only a universe that expands will permit the existence of life. Which is why Bordé and Blinken and Guth said all reasonable cosmic models are subject to the relentless grip of the space-time theorems. Any model of the universe that permits physical life must be traceable back to a space-time beginning where you've got a causal agent that creates independent of space and time.
Thank you.
Hi. Some people, I've heard, believe that there are these little space people that come from someplace out there, how populated the Earth is, and that, I mean, I don't personally believe it, but I've heard it said that they come to Earth to populate or to give us whatever
in the past.
Can you please discuss that
and
why it is or is not possible that would happen?
Well, we wrote a book on this called Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. I'm not sure it's on the table there, but you can get that off of our website or through Amazon or whatever. But what we point out in that book is that the idea that physical beings have come here to planet Earth actually does violate the laws of physics. It's certainly possible for physical life to travel throughout our planetary system. So it's not beyond the possibility that we could land men on Mars. It's not easy, but it can be done. But trying to get to the next star system, that's a big challenge. And the problem is not even going warp one is that you can't even go warp 0.01. If you go warp 0.01, which is 1% the velocity of light,
you're going to be doing significant damage to your ship and the inhabitants on board. And now you're talking, if you're going less than 1% the velocity of light, a very long time to get to another star system. And the problem with that is that people who believe in extraterrestrial intelligent life, which I don't, have calculated that the maximum time in which you can sustain technology at a level beyond what we've been manifesting since World War II is at most 2,000 years.